Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. The wireless operator, the untold story of the British sailor who invented the modern drug trade. Now and again, a book will land on my desk from production, and I didn't so much raise an eyebrow as almost lose most of my receding hairline in shock. This is a fabulous story. The story of Harold Durber, one of the largest marijuana traffickers in American history. It is by David Tuck, and I'm delighted to say that David joins me right now, not from a plantation somewhere in Jamaica, but from a rather well-stocked library somewhere. David, good morning to you.
Hi, Giles. Good morning to you. Great to see you.
Great to have you. Before we get going, explain to a little bit about, because there's a family connection here, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. So Harold Durber is actually my cousin. And it was a crazy story where I was doing some family tree research and I was trading notes with a distant relative, and he said, oh, by the way, you should look into our mutual cousin, this guy named Harold Durber. He was a major gunrunner and drug trafficker. He was shot down by professional hitmen in Miami, and it was one of those introductions that was really hard to turn away from.
So set the scene, if you will, then, about, because this is a Brit, because when you say shot down in Miami, obviously we will go to Tony Montana and Scarface here. So who is he? What period are we talking about timeline-wise?
Yeah, so Harold Durber was born Hyman Tuchfer Durber in Manchester, England, in Cheetham Hill, which is the Jewish quarter of Manchester. He was born in 1926, so came of age as a teenager during the height of World War II, and subjected to a very harrowing experience growing up during the war. So the Manchester Blitz, he suffered tuberculosis twice. There were Jewish detention camps in England, which not a lot of people are aware of. And then at the very tender age of 16, he signs up with the British Merchant Navy to be a wireless operator or a radio operator, and then ships off first with the Dutch merchant fleet as a wireless operator with the British Merchant Navy.
Is this just after the war? Is this during the war? Is it just, I mean, what period are we talking here? What time are we talking here?
Yeah, so he was 13 in 1939, so he was a teenager when war broke out. So we're talking right at the cusp of the war, and then he shipped out with the British Merchant Navy in 1943.
Right.
So this is at the height of the Battle of the Atlantic.
Oh, wow, so he's doing the convoys. So yeah,
that's right.
Okay, so that is so for with the convoys, it's either nothing happens or everything happens, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to imagine young Hyman Tuchfer Durber, 17 years old, serving with the Dutch merchant fleet. So these guys are all, you know, almost 2 meters tall. You know, they've been at sea for many years now, and he's the only non-Dutchman on these ships. And later on, he moves over to the Norwegian merchant navy, which actually had the highest fatality rate, even though they were civilian service. They had the highest fatality rate of any service during the war. So it was a very, very harrowing experience. So it was a case of out of the frying pan and into the fire. So escaping, you know, all the harrowing stuff going on in Manchester. And then you find yourself, you know, outrunning torpedoes in the middle of the Atlantic.
When does he actually change his surname? Because obviously we know him in the book, you know, by the name, you know, by the name of Harold Durber. Is it when he becomes in the Merchant Navy, it's going to be easier? And because of the, you know, the usual, you know, anti-Semitism that's been going around for, should we say, the last couple of thousand years, then he decides it's going to be easier for him to invent himself as a merchant navy officer, and not because there is you know, people will still take a crack at you even with that name.
Yeah, so he changed his name in 1944, and it was part of a broader trend for a lot of Jews with Germanic sounding names to anglicize their names. So the whole family actually changed the name to Durber. And it's also the origin of my name, because the original name Tuchfer Durber, the German side of the family took Tuch or Tuck, which is my name. And then the British side of the family took Durber.
Ah, okay. So the front cover, I'm getting David Niven vibes here. He's a great suit, little mustache. He looks every inch the, you know, the British gentleman who's got to walk on part in a Noel Coward play, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Comes, you know, straight out of the golden age of Hollywood with the pencil mustache and the pinstripe suit and the, you know, the lapels at just the right angle and the cufflinks. His undercover agent that was pursuing him could have named him Errol Flynn. So you can definitely see the resemblance. And I think that was also part of his persona as a fraudster, so he could project this image as the dignified British gentleman while he was undertaking these massive frauds.
So he goes through, you know, the harrowing situation in the Atlantic, and you know, and for those who go, oh well, it's, you know, the Battle of the Atlantic it's not one of the things that springs to mind, but it is the most important thing that happens, because without the supplies coming across the Atlantic and without the Liberty boats and the American troops being shipped over and Lend-Lease coming out of the Soviet Union, the Baltic, which is where the Norwegians lose so tremendous amounts of people, you know, Britain and the Empire basically grinds to a halt. So it is perhaps the most important and most overlooked strong, because there are no battlefields in the Battle of the Atlantic.
Exactly. Yeah, the Norwegian Merchant Navy had one of the highest fatality rates in the war, with 1 in 6 sailors perishing during the war. And it was the U-boats' tactics to specifically target the convoy supply lines in order to starve the British Isles. So, very, very critical in the war. After the war, he goes to the next major hotspot, which is the Arab-Israeli War. So the U.S., U.K., and Arab League imposed a arms blockade, preventing arms being delivered into Israel. So he and a lot of other British sailors, both Jews and non-Jews, volunteered to smuggle illegal weapons into Israel. So here he's outrunning the blockades manned by British Royal Navy sailors that he had just been fighting shoulder to shoulder with a few years ago. And many of these weapons were actually sourced from Nazi surplus in Czechoslovakia that Stalin had seized. And so Russia was one of the first nations to recognize the State of Israel and supported them militarily. And so he was running Nazi surplus arms through the British blockade to deliver illegal arms into Israel.
You've got to love history, because it's never black and white. Is he doing this? I suppose you could say he is doing this because he wants to help found the nation, etc., and you know, help found, you know, after the privations of the Second World War. But would it be fair to say, and I know this is family, David, but he's got an eye for an opportunity, to put it mildly?
Yeah, I think that's putting it mildly. I mean, he had an absolute lust for adventure. And so I think he was more motivated by the thrill and the financial prospects rather than any ideological Zionism. So interestingly, he had a very complicated relationship with his Jewish heritage. He would never refer to it. He scrubbed all references to his Jewish identity in all of his immigration documents. And obviously the name Derber has a British sounding name to it. So it was, I think, for him and a lot of the other sailors, you know, where the next party was happening after the war. It was the first major state conflict after World War II. And after the armistice, he realized there was a huge opportunity to continue smuggling German surplus weapons. And in this case, he had a deal with Rafael Trujillo, who was the dictatorial leader of the Dominican Republic, to essentially create his armamentarium. So he was aiming to direct German surplus weapons and whitewashing them through Israel, because it was otherwise illegal to export German arms, and sending those on to the dictatorial government of the Dominican Republic. He had a $41 million line of credit, which is about $500 million in today's money, in order to build up Trujillo's military.
And the thing is, of course, these are men who have seen the horrors of the convoys, and seen the horrors of war. So though we might think, oh my goodness, how can they do this? You know, to a generation of people, he's been through the Manchester Blitz. He's, you know, he's obviously seen some horrendous things at sea that he doesn't really want to talk about. And so this is just if you've lived through the Second World War, then gun running isn't going to be a problem. And also, one of the nastiest dictators of that region, you know, who's running a particular part of the world. I mean, so he is a little mercenary, because I mean, people sort of have overlooked Trujillo, but he was a particularly nasty character, David.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this was right at the time that the Brits and the Americans stopped arming Trujillo. So he was sort of a favored partner for quite some time, but then they cut off arms. And so he was desperate to secure arms illegally. And my cousin was very happy to step into the breach.
Now, if you're thinking about that particular area, you're thinking about the Caribbean Sea, you're thinking about Dominican Republic, other areas near there. There's a very, very large area, island as well, just close to there, which is Cuba. Now, at that point, of course, that is under another dictator, You know, so Havana is the place to be. You've got, you know, it is the era of Copacabana. And again, you've got CIA running operations. You've got mafia running operations. It must have been a very, if you're looking for an update, you know, if you were going to remake Pirates of the Caribbean and set it anywhere, I think sort of early 50s, sort of Caribbean, Miami, Dominican Republic would be probably the place that would be sort of Johnny Depp's or Captain Jack Sparrow's sort of equivalent, would it, in 20th century?
Yeah, absolutely. So my cousin had an absolute knack for finding where the next hotspot was. And after the Bay of Pigs invasion, he thought, okay, that's the place to be. So in the late 1950s, he moves down to Miami and starts a luxury cruise ship between Miami and Bimini Island in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
And this is at the time that a lot of the Havana Mafia got kicked out of Havana when Castro took power. So Meyer Lansky and that whole lot. So they set up a floating casino on my cousin's boat because gambling was legal in international waters once we were 3 miles beyond into international waters. And so he was running this floating casino sponsored by, you know, the best of the Miami Mafia. And it's at this time that he meets the love of his life, who's this absolutely gorgeous woman named Sari Leslie. So she and her identical twin become the entertainment directors on his ship. But she has a secret past of her own. She's using his ship as a cover to smuggle illegal documents and cash out of Havana. So she was most likely contracted by the CIA to be a courier to get the greenbacks out of Havana while Castro was nationalizing all the U.S. subsidiaries on the island.
I'm just thinking, does he not get involved with sort of the Bay of Pigs? Is he not getting going in sort of helping support the Cuban, you know, the Cuban exiles to try, you know, at that point to get back in and topple Castro? Because obviously, you know, I mean, Kennedy. Well, we can have a whole conversation about Kennedy not backing the troops up. And there's all sorts of things with, you know, the Cuba, what was it, the Cuban National, the Cuban Exiles Air Force, you know, bombing Valparaiso. But you know, did he not get involved with sort of gun running, sort of more covertly, you know, direct to the, not Castro's lot, but obviously the Miami Cuban Exiles?
Yeah, absolutely. So after the Bay of Pigs invasion, it's not widely known that 1,100 members of the invasion force were held captive in Cuba on a very desolate island called Isle of Pines. And Castro rigged the island with explosives that were set to go off if the Yankees tried to do another invasion. And the Kennedy administration wanted to negotiate for the release of these prisoners, but they had to do it through a third party so they could maintain deniable separation. So they sent one of their fixers down there, a guy named James Brennan, who paid Castro a $50 million ransom to free the Bay of Pigs prisoners. But the only catch was they needed a private ship to ferry back the Bay of Pigs prisoners. And I think you see where this is going. So my cousin volunteered his cruise ship to return back the Bay of Pigs prisoners. He wrote a telegram to JFK, which is in the JFK archives, and the White House accepted. But for then some reason, they pulled out at the last minute. I think they might have done an FBI background check and realized that he was tied up with the Miami mob. So they pulled out and he said, well, that's okay. I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. I don't need your permission. And they said, well, wait a second. There's a travel embargo against Cuba. You can't do private business with the Cuban government. And he said, well, actually, I renounced my U.S. visa. I'm not a U.S. subject anymore. I'm a British subject. And so therefore, the Kennedy embargo doesn't apply to me. And I'm going to go ahead. And so he met with the founder of Cuban intelligence and signed an exclusive agreement to provide the only transportation out of Cuba, recognizing that it was both a humanitarian crisis, but also the financial opportunity of a lifetime, because there were about 250,000 Cubans with U.S. visas, but no way to get off the island. So they were essentially trapped. And he realized there was this loophole where, because he was not a U.S. subject, he could offer them transportation to the States. And that's when the full weight of the CIA and the State Department really came crashing down on him.
Because the love of his life, presumably, because she might just possibly sort of know what's going on with this one.
Yeah, and it's not clear if she was monitoring him, and I don't know if he knew that he was most likely contracting for the agency, and I don't know if she knew that he was tied up with Cuban intelligence, but there's a bit of a Mr. and Mrs. Smith situation where they're both working for rival intelligence agencies and are playing this very coy cat and mouse game with each other. But the two of them met with Castro a number of times. The ferry operation was a major project that Castro was very interested in because it was a huge embarrassment to the Kennedy administration, and he wanted to get rid of all these counter-revolutionaries. So they were working very closely with Castro during this time. And my cousin was harassed all over the Caribbean, so they sent mobs after him in the Cayman Islands. He was attacked in Jamaica, and basically, you know, through the archival research, I've been able to show that the Kennedy administration was, you know, seeking to basically suppress him every step of the way. Eventually, they're successful, and they do a test run with 24 Cubans from Cuba to Key West, and they don't know what to charge him with because it wasn't illegal. So they charge him with reckless operation of a boat, which doesn't stick. And so he loses the court case and is deported back to England in 64.
So, I mean, we've got gun running, we've got basically sort of people smuggling or whatever you want to call it. But then there's the sweet smell of the herb. And I suppose these days, I mean, marijuana smuggling, it almost sounds sort of admirable, isn't it, with the horrors of what's going on at the moment. But how does he branch off into this one? Because it's a very sort of two things. One, there's a very sort of ambivalent attitude to drugs, perhaps. And B, you know, they're not really sort of this, the CIA or the, is there even a DEA at this point to stop sort of weed coming, as it were?
No, so the DEA wasn't established until 74. So he's deported back to England in 64 and then undertakes various forms of financial fraud, trafficking in illegal bonds in Canada, makes his way down to Suriname, serves jail time in Honduras, Mexico, and Colombia for various forms of financial fraud. He's eking out a living as a lobster farmer in Mexico. And then something really amazing happens, which is that in 1970, President Nixon signs the Controlled Substances Act, which is what gave America its current scheduling system of drug classification. And they effed up royally. So they nullified all the previous drug laws so that they could have one coherent statute that covered all of the disparate drug laws. And they forgot to reinstate the law that made it illegal to have drugs in international waters. It was a complete screw up.
Yeah.
And my cousin probably realized that there were drug smuggling captains that were being arrested in international waters, but not convicted because the US government had no basis to convict drug traffickers in international waters. And so again, he realizes that this is a huge financial opportunity, and he invents what becomes known as the mothership method of drug smuggling, where he would take a cargo freighter, fill it with 50 tons of weed, park in the middle of the Atlantic, and then have speedboats race out and do the drug transfer mid-ocean. And those boats would then take it back to shore. But what those boats did was somebody else's problem. The mothership was completely legal dispensing weed in international waters. And so he would load up a cargo ship and drop off thousands of tons of weed all the way from Florida up to Newfoundland. And in doing so, he became the largest marijuana trafficker in American history and defined the dominant mode of drug transportation, which was through this mothership technique.
Can you just dial it back here? Because I had visions of him lurking somewhere in the Caribbean, but he's got a cargo ship. And he's going basically up the East Coast in international water, all the way up the East Coast. And people are coming out. So I envisioned people meeting him at the Keys and then taking it through sort of Florida. But no, he's actually, because they can't touch him, he's off the East Coast.
Exactly. So he had a dozen cargo ships, each with anywhere from 30 to 60 tons of capacity. Each ship was roughly doing one run a month. And the flagship, the premier ship, was called the Night Train. And this became the bete noire of maritime drug enforcement, because in addition to exploiting the mothership loophole, he used a lot of his skills as a radio officer in the British Merchant Navy to undertake very sophisticated counter surveillance and detection evasion. So they used sideband radio and voice scramblers and a lot of spycraft in order to avoid detection. And this would eventually lead him to amassing a huge drug fortune.
Because this is obviously this is the time when it's like basically peace and love, man. And sort of, you know, all the other people are doing it are bringing it on like Volkswagen, sort of Volkswagen Beetles from Mexico, sort of stuff. And they haven't got the training, and the Americans have got their have basically got their hands full or whatever, because they're still dealing with whatever's coming back from the fallout from Southeast Asia, as we'd call it then. And they've got they're trying to do their sort out their mob laws and the whole bit. So it's a whole mess, isn't it, for the American administration?
Yeah, there was a huge crackdown on road-based drug transfer. In 1970, Nixon launched Operation Intercept, which inspected every single vehicle coming over the Mexican border. It led to eight-hour delays on the Mexican border. And the use of maritime drug trafficking completely blindsided the Nixon administration. So it was also this time that marijuana production was shifting from Jamaica and Mexico, which had a herbicidal eradication program financially sponsored by the U.S.
Yeah.
So marijuana production was now shifting to Colombia. So my cousin would load up in Barranquilla and then take the Windward Passage between Cuba and Hispaniola and then up and down the Atlantic seaboard.
Presumably, the you know, this isn't a case of because sort of the mob, etc., they're sort of having a turf war at the moment in the 70s, like the five main families in Chicago and New York. And so they're not really, and again, that generation aren't look at drugs as something they don't want to get involved in. They want to do racketeering, larceny, prostitution, the normal stuff. And the South, you know, you mentioned Mexico, Colombia, they haven't come on stream as they will do with obviously cartels and cocaine.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, drugs are such a staple part of our culture now, it's hard to look back to that period when marijuana use was just beginning. So in 1969, only 5% of high school students reported smoking marijuana. Until late 1970s, where that figure is closer to 40 or 50%. And we usually think of that in terms of the spread of the counterculture and maybe the Vietnam vets coming back and self-medicating their PTSD. But on the supply side, that was only made possible by the mothership revolution, yeah, which could provide, you know, this massive quantity of marijuana needed to meet the skyrocketing demand. And yeah, this is long before Pablo Escobar and the rise of the Medellin cartel, which really wouldn't kick off until 76. Yeah. So a number of years later. So at this stage, Escobar is, you know, stealing cars and, you know, trafficking contraband cigarettes.
I mean, is it a case that he's not, but he's, what's his lifestyle like at this point? I mean, is he, yeah. I mean, he's not doing the 70s drug lord thing with a Lincoln Continental.
So here's the crazy thing, Giles. He's the largest marijuana trafficker in the country. He had been deported or banned from about seven countries at this stage. He had served jail time in Miami, Jamaica, Mexico, Colombia,
and Honduras. Survived Honduras and Colombia.
He had been deported twice from America, once as a national security risk, and he's living openly in Miami. So he was able to secure a U.S. visa in 1973, and he's living on Millionaire's Row on Miami Beach, splitting his time between Cartagena and Miami. So there, I don't have any direct evidence, but it's definitely very suspicious that he was able to secure a U.S. visa live openly as a major drug trafficker in Miami. It's interesting. I did a Freedom of Information request for his DEA file, and the agency denied it under the exemption for techniques and procedures. And I appealed that, saying, come on, guys, it was 50 years ago. The subject is deceased. He's a family member. It's of high historical interest. And in response to my appeal, they said, oh, sorry, we destroyed all his files.
Ah, yes, of course. Left out in the rain. We want people to go and buy the book, so we won't sort of give the whole story, David. But, you know, I mean, when you write a book like this, you know, it's about a family member, you know, it's a tricky one to write, isn't it? Because you can go down that whole sort of, it was a different time, they were only doing it for themselves. You know, I'm thinking Johnny Depp and Blow, the movie, that one, and it's almost like, oh, these are the good guys. And there's been this whole romanticization with, like, narcos, oh, they weren't really that bad. People did still get hurt, and people did still get killed. So when you come to write this, how difficult is it for you to keep a straight bat, as we'd say, you know, cricket-wise?
Yeah, I tried not to romanticize him because he's obviously a very easy figure to be charmed by. He was very dapper, very urbane, very clever. And the fact that he had a certain gentlemanly code where he didn't engage in violence, didn't traffic any of the hard drugs, would make it easy to excuse him. But he was also very heavily involved in the guns for drugs trade. So after he was dropping off the weed in America on the return trip, he was delivering guns to the Marxist guerrillas in Latin America, which just unleashed a wave of havoc throughout Colombia and Nicaragua and Honduras. So even though marijuana itself is pretty benign, particularly, you know, when we look at it with today's lens, the industry itself, you know, fed a wave of violence in Latin America. So I tried to keep that in mind when I was writing the book to appreciate that there's a larger context as well. But I did, you know, try to fight myself from glorifying or romanticizing him, despite the fact that he's a pretty charming character.
And I mean, he comes to an end, presumably, if he's running guns to, you know, presumably FARC guys down in Colombia. He's got, you know, there is an emerging drug trade. Somewhere is going to be miffed off with him. So is there, I mean, don't spoil it completely, but is there a, smoking guns, not the right thing to say, but do you have a theory, or was there a definite theory about, you know, what happened to him in the end?
Yeah, so he was assassinated by two professional hitmen outside of his condominium in Miami. And interestingly, those same two hitmen had killed his lookalike, or it might have been a case of mistaken identity, 5 months prior. And there are several theories. When I talk with his drug trafficking associates, who I interviewed extensively for the book, they're convinced it was the government. They will swear up and down it was the government that took him out. He was killed the day before he was scheduled to testify into a SEC investigation into his money laundering of his drug proceeds. So there could have been, you know, some interest in taking him out for that reason. You mentioned the New York families earlier. He was money laundering for the Gambinos, so they might have had an interest in taking him out. He had a lot of enemies in the Cuban exile community. Could have been the Colombians, who had $250,000 contract on his head. So it's very much like the Kennedy assassination, where it could have been, you know, anyone's pick as to who killed him. I definitely have various theories. They tend to change from 1 week to the next, but he had, you know, basically every criminal faction at the time, you know, looking to take him out. So it's a bit of a mystery.
Listeners, if you're going to do one thing today, go and order this book on the TRE virtual bookstore. It will blow your mind. The book is called The Wireless Operator, the untold story of the British sailor who invented the modern drug trade. It's by David Took, who's speaking to you today. David, if people want to find you and say lovely things to you online, do you have a website, do you have social media? Where can people find you?
Yeah, come check us out at davidtuck.com. You can subscribe to our newsletter, where we give updates as we get new information. We're expecting a CIA file this summer, which should be really interesting. Oh. And the book's available on Amazon and wherever books are sold.
You are coming back on when that file is brought to light. It's been absolutely brilliant. It's even better than I even thought it was going to be. The book is called The Wireless Operator. It's by David Took. David, thank you so much for your time today.
That was a lot of fun. Thanks so much.